Welcome to the Musky 360 Podcast, a Jaybird.
Hey, Steve.
I'm broadcasting yet again live from the Musky Shop Jeep Studios here. Back home, but I'm pulling a double, buddy. So
that's a double guide trip for those not in the know.
Pulling the old sun up to sundowner, doing the thing. But anyway, hit it this week. I got such a crazy travel schedule coming up. Just got back a couple days ago, and I'm right back in her here. What's going on with you?
Hey, Labor Day weekend, so off a few days here and join the great outdoors, Steve.
Gotcha.
Do a little fishing today, yeah.
Very nice, very nice. Gonna hit the lakes or hit the rivers or what's going, is it packed up there? I'm assuming it's busy up in the North Woods.
Yeah, there's a lot of people. Yeah. It's just like perfect conditions, like, you know, no wind. Well, I mean, perfect vacationing conditions, maybe not for fishing. It's like,
right.
You know, low 70s, light and variable winds. But, you know, this is the last gasp of summer, probably. We got some cold weather coming, baby.
Yeah, it's nuts. We down here, I thank goodness, obviously, I spend, you know, July and August, I'm not down here. And avoided a bunch of days of 100.
Yeah, just horrible heat.
Jody Michael was like, I hate you. I'll be like, yeah, it's 60 today. You know, I came back yesterday on the water. It was like 83 and I thought I was going to die. I'm just not acclimated to it at all. I was like,
Yeah, back every day up in Canada, and back when you're up here before you left, it was like, okay, how many sweatshirts do I have?
Yeah,
exactly. So I'd like to wear like two or three of them at the same time.
Exactly. Keep it nice and mild. Avoid the pits of hell that is the South in August. So no, but it's mild out here. It's funny. You know, you would think Labor Day would be absolutely crowded, but I think that heat scared everybody out of here. You know, who's going to make plans? I think everybody headed up north because, you know, we've got the big tourism area here and it is a dead zone just because it's just been brutal heat. But whatever, we got safe water temperatures, so I'm rocking and rolling. But, well, what's the word on the street, Jay? What are you hearing the bite is up there? Since we can't get anybody to do the North Woods Muskie report here, what's the bite that you're hearing right now?
Yeah, well, temps have been swinging like crazy. So, you know, we had some really cool weather, and we've got some really cool nights. It's brought the water temps down.
Uh-huh.
I did a little exploring the other night after work, I think Friday night, and I was out on the local reservoir here, and it was crazy shallow, huge schools of minnows, which is that first indicator for me on some of the water that I fish that it's, you know, weeds are dying off.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that green kind of algae crap floating towards shore.
Yep.
Weeds are breaking up. Water temps is cooled enough where that little migration in the early fall when there's a lot of bait. And so yeah, there was some smallmouth and pike chasing Sydney Muskie, but that had just started. So yeah, people are looking at that, kind of that pre-turnover thing kicking in really soon here, and with highs around 50 to 55 by midweek.
Oh yeah,
sucker fishing, all that stuff's going to come into play, and top water fishing, blades up shallow.
Mm-hmm. It. Yeah, it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually seeing. It's funny. I'm sitting right now at a boat ramp, shockingly, and even here, just the. And I'm talking just the first tinge of change in the trees.
Okay.
Where, you know, and usually that's not the case here, but it's coming early. I mean, and it was kind of dicey last week. We talked about it heavily, whether it's fall or not, or what's happening, or, you know, but now we're right in the thick of it. So, I mean, that's one thing. I mean, getting ahead on those fall patterns. I'm up on the app, I actually went ahead and threw up a bunch of like some of the really solid fall trolling content and the some good Booker articles and some of my articles out there about fall to just get people's heads kind of pointed in that direction. You know,
speaking of trolling, plus that big trolling video you did too.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was done this winter, but here it is now. Yeah, that was fun. If you check that, we got that on the app and on the Musky Shops YouTube there, which is me and a small whiteboard. But now, fortunately, I have a bigger whiteboard. That was the start. We've got a couple more going here, but kind of crawling, crawling through the mind of it here, of what we can think about when it comes to trolling and a few different options, you know, of what you can get going. And, you know, realistically, just that you might be on that summer pattern now, but, you know, getting ahead of things, thinking ahead. So you're not, you want to be ahead. You don't want to be behind. You want to be the guy that finds the next bite, not the guy that's sitting around going, what are they hitting? And, you know, making that early transition or dedicating some time, you know, and especially Jay, you're talking about these big minnow schools. You know, obviously LiveScope's thrown a monkey wrench in it where some people go, well, I just, you know, they're scanning open water and all this stuff. I'm still all about just fall trolling, you know, especially when you get those big bait schools. I mean, there's certain places, I know Jamie Pastile, talked to him the other day, and it's just like, you know, up on his water, they get the worm where it's miles and miles of bait. You know, you get massive concentrations of bait fish in the fall. And Jay, like if you're seeing those schooling fish and they're typically in open water or above the main basin. And it's something to capitalize on where you'll still have some bait fish in the weeds, i.e. perch and walleye, but that congregating bait out in open water is just ridiculous. Just absolutely ridiculous what you can get into there. So, you know, but Jay, you said suckers. Are we stocked up now? Because it's going to turn that quick.
We're getting there. It looks like the suppliers that trap the suckers that we buy, which are wild suckers, not pond raised, you know, the good ones. It looks like availability is going to be pretty good. So we should be able to be stocking up this week. We've got enough right now, but like I said, it's kind of warm and it hasn't really kicked in yet.
I'll tell you, this is one of one might say, oh, it's been weird. It really has. This is like the most normal spring and transition times I've seen, where it's doing what it, like historically it should be doing. Like if you look back 15 years ago, this is like normal, but it's, you know, we've been on the roller coaster ride of just crazy weather for what, the last 5-6 years, you know, where it's up and down and, you know, you either have a super late ice or super early, all this stuff. So I think we're kind of on par, which is interesting to finally be there. I imagine winter will be hell.
you never know.
You never know. I mean,
yeah, right. It's like, you know, we, last couple of years here, we hardly had any snow. And, you know, for us having no snowmobile trails open or for very limited time is not a good thing. So,
yeah,
normal year. Like, hey, it's easier to get dialed in when things are normal.
Well,
or as normal as they can be.
Normal as they can. Yeah, normal as they can be, but, you know, a little bit more on brand where, okay, September's not just another month of summer. And it's a lot of years where it's just September's just hotter than blue blazes. And then you kind of have that shock where you go, oh, everything changed. Mm-hmm. And I think from a fishing standpoint, it's like, okay, you might be able to, you can capitalize on a couple things at once. You know, a couple patterns at once, opposed to just like, okay, everything's shallow. Oh, now everything's suspended over the main base, right? And so you'll be able to pick off on a couple different things. Anyway, the comings and goings at the Muskie shop, even with it being freaking end of August, there's actually some big new and exciting products, Jay.
Yeah, Friday was hectic. Yeah,
hectic. Go ahead. Obviously, one thing, thanks everybody so much. It has just blown up like crazy is the Mustang. You got to, they had to reorder already. So there's a new stock of Mustangs at the Muskie shop. So if you missed out on a color you wanted or you didn't, you know, didn't get what you wanted there, just got a whole restock there, which is crazy. It only took about 5 days. So you guys wipe those out.
And I'll be putting another one in Tuesday.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Mm-hmm.
It's nuts. I'll tell you what's awesome about that is, and I love the color, is Swamp Thing, which is actually was made for the European market, and a bunch of Muskie guys are buying it because it is kind of like a baby pike kind of deal. And the other one, which was for the Euro market, which is Burnt Roach, which is kind of like a dirty nickel color, which is just kind of killer. But yeah, it's funny. Those are gone ballistic. So the price is right, Jay.
Yeah, it's a great bait. It really
freaking
is.
Crushing on it.
And so, they're catching fish.
Catching the hell out of them. The one thing that's interesting, I can't believe they introduced them this late in the year, is the Musky X rods from St. Croix.
Yeah. Yeah. Those just came out too. Those came in Friday as well.
Yeah, which is, I mean, best way to put it, it's a budget friendly St. Croix. Mm-hmm. Is this to replace Mojo, or do you know what the trajectory is there, or what the goal of that is?
What's their vision down the road? I have no idea. It is changing with them. I'm not sure they do.
Right.
I'm pretty sure they're going to be keeping Mojo around, you know, just to paraphrase what they've been doing. The Mojo series, which was that, you know, kind of that purple blank deal,
yep.
It was kind of an economy line rod, right. More or less. It went with the Grasp 2 handles this year, so they all have them.
Right.
And so that bumped the price up a bit. So this Musky X series that just came out is very similar to the Mojo. It's made in their plant in Mexico as well.
Aye,
so
aye.
The price is down. And they don't have that feature with that Grasp 2. It's just a little bit more simplified. They still got cork, EVA, all that deal. Split grip, full grip.
Uh-huh.
18 models.
18. I made another good musky rod, boss. Anyway.
Yeah, so there's lots of option, boys.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy. I mean, was it 195? Is that flat rate? No, okay, up to 210. What we got here? I'm just 235.
They're like 190 to 300.
310.
They've got some telescoping. They're all one piece, but they've got some telescoping. They've got some fixed 9-foot rods too, for those that don't want a telly. So, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of options.
You got one piecers.
They look good. They look good. Yeah. We had a little bit of time when we were trying to hurriedly check them in and get them on the floor Friday to check them out. And they look just fine. The quality's real good.
Yeah, and the other stuff, believe it or not, you got Drop Time Tackle. It's a brand that's kind of been on our radar there, and I actually got to meet Thatcher, the man behind that brand, up in Canada.
Oh, did you?
Okay. Yeah. And then kind of gave the boys a holler at the shop and said, we got to get this stuff. And I think kind of the coolest things, the thing that really caught my eye is the base jumper, which is Magnum 8 that is front weighted. So it's a 4.9 ounce bucktail, and it gets down. And so that's kind of a neat presentation. I'm not the world's biggest bucktailer, but when we're doing a heavy-weighted bucktail, that's a neat presentation for sure. And then I appreciate the heck out of it, and kind of the one thing that they're known for, they make a lot of lake trout tubes. But they have their chunker tube and the Hunger Strike,
yeah,
which are downsized tubes for, yeah, if you're a lake trout guy, perfect, but also is a throwback on muskies.
Throwback and downsize, yeah.
Yeah, one and a half ounce, 6-inch deal here. And I mean, lake trout are a mean critter. These can handle muskies. They're meant to handle muskies. And they're killer little setups. I like they come pre-dressed with a blade on them too. You know, so it's for $10. Are you kidding me? They're you're giving them away. You know, they're practically giving these things away for $10. So, something to add to your arsenal just to have on hand. I actually have a couple. I actually bought them there at Clark's. That's before we had them there, and I was kind of experimenting with them. I'm like, these are just knockouts. Just
cool,
super handy thing. Caught a big walleye on one too, Jay. Big Walter. Right in the face.
Down by you or up in Canada?
No, up in Canada.
Oh,
caught a big Walter on them. So they're kind of a cool presentation, man. I'm into it. So new and exciting stuff. That is the comings and the goings at the Musky Shop there.
Yeah, we got some more drop time coming in too. They shipped half our order actually. So there's more coming. There's a spinner bait and something else coming too. I don't even know.
Nice. I mean, they're a small operation, and he's doing his best to keep up as always, but you know, just it's cool when you get some handmade in Canada stuff there. You know, they're making it out of every component's made out of beaver pelt or something, I believe. Birch bark and beaver pelt. Authentic Canadian blades. The blades are carved individually from beaver teeth. Hand-carved beaver teeth blades complement the beaver fur skirt. You know, okay, they have things up there, Jay. I was just there. They have normal things. It's not everything's made out of things they found in the woods.
They offer pizza too.
They have pizza. They just found out about there's a Pizza Hut now. They found out about Pizza Hut, so they brought one of those in. They all lost their minds. Now they're trying to get as fat as Americans up there. Found out, boys, you can't out Pizza the Hut. We got to bring one of these sons of bitches into town. Somebody crossed the border and saw a Pizza Hut and lost their ever loving mind and said, "Boys, we need one of them. Whatever it takes."
Gotta have one now.
Now there were riots. Oh, we'll burn down the old pulp mill if we don't get a Pizza Hut.
Okay, that's enough. Okay.
Oh, we got so much Q&A to get to here. Here's Dave.
Oh, okay.
Got a question. Been musky fishing a while and always fish lakes. Just broke out and caught my first ever river musky using tactics heard on the podcast. Good deal.
Cool.
Question is, when the boat is on spot lock fishing a pool and you have a fish on, it was very tough and nerve-wracking to net that fish in current. Is there any special tricks that you have up your sleeve for fighting a fish in current to make it easier? Yes. So, when I hook up to a fish in current, if I am using spot lock, my first move is to turn off spot lock. Now we're on even footing.
Makes right? sense.
What will happen is we hook up with a fish, say it's out in a pool, right? Or he's on a current seam or whatever it might be, and you spot lock to that. Yes, the boat is stationary, but the water is screeching around you depending on speed. And you hook up to that fish, where's he going to go? Generally downstream, and they usually end up way down from you. And now you're fighting a fish against current. When the boat is drifting, the current is kind of a mute point. And you'll notice, like, if you spot lock in a river, figure eighting is tough, right? If it's really moving, it can be difficult because you're fighting the current against your rod. I try to use spot lock minimally, especially, it's like if I know there's a pocket, a pool, or whatever that I need to hit, I'll spot lock to ensure that I'm getting my saturation casting in there. But the second I hook up, just hit that thing off and drift. And it kind of evens the playing field because netting a fish, you know, you're dragging him upstream. The chances of him coming off are way worse, right? Just way worse. So just go with the flow is my answer to that. You know, obviously make sure that you got clearance, you know, if you don't want to go backwards over the waterfall or something like that, but you know, you want to be on your A game there and make sure that we're kind of paying attention. But it really alleviates a lot of the tension and the pressure on that fish. And you're going to land them easier. It's not every time, but 99.999% of the time, the fish is going to run downstream. So just keep that in mind and go from there. Season to taste, Jay.
Mm-hmm.
Season to taste. Candom. Do you guys have any tips for fishing Audubon Lake in North Dakota? We actually have a couple friends that fish North Dakota, Jay. Low population density, I think, would get around that one. You know, there's some tough water there. I mean, the biggest thing I can tell you, especially when you're fishing a place that has little to no history, is you're going to have to be an explorer. You know, you can't just go out and you're not going to the community spots on bodies of water that don't have community spots because nobody's fishing them. You're going to have to get creative. I would pay major attention to your solar lunar windows, right? To see if there's anything that has influence on the fish in that body of water. Some places it matters, some places it doesn't. Some timing can be influenced by so many things. But look at those factors. And what I would be doing every single day that I'm fishing a new body of water like that doesn't have history is I'm going to be deep into map study, and then on the water I'm going to be hitting, you know, multiple spots per day that kind of check all the boxes of mid, shallow, and deep until I have a pattern or until I establish something noteworthy, right? It's difficult, like I said, when you don't have, you know, like a lake like Leech Lake. Everybody knows Federal Dam or this, that, and the other. You know, there's so many of these lakes. You, through osmosis in muskie fishing, I can tell you some of the most noteworthy places on these major lakes because they got 100 years of history on them. But North Dakota, there's not a lot of history, so you're going to have to be an explorer and have to really branch out, do your map study, and go from there. Anyway, let me look here. Hold on. My email, Jay. Mm-hmm. James, where should I look to find a muskie in a small lake with healthy... They have a healthy population up to about 45 inches, but average 30 inches. The lake's 20 to 30 feet in the middle and all weeds on the shoreline usually sticking out. If you got a small lake and there's a bunch of 30s up to 45 and you got weed beds, guess where I'm looking, Jay? Looking the weeds.
Structure.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it's a small lake and we got shoreline cover like that and it's like a main basin of 30, I mean, start at the weeds until they're gone, right? If it's 20s and 30s and up to 45s, that reminds me of like a Wildcat and Boulder Junction kind of scenario, Jay. There's structure, but there's a bunch of them in the weeds if you got high population density. So I'm going to start there. And if it's not happening, right, don't spend all day beating that. Again, same as to Candon, is look at your map. You know, if you don't have a map of that place, make one. Be observant of your electronics, but look for structure. Now, what you'll find is, in general, your bigger fish are more structure-oriented than they're cover-oriented, but that's what I'm going to look at. And, I mean, if you got a body of water that has a lot of 30s and, you know, high 30s, mid-30s, whatever it might be, you can get away with a lot of bullshit. All right? You can throw a single, you can throw a Booker tail all day, score some fish. You can, you know, Smitty Whiz. You know, you don't have to be hucking and chucking big stuff to score out there. So start shallow, then work your way out through the course of the day, and then work your way back in. That's going to be the easiest way to attack a small body of water, kind of that way.
Yeah, and if the weed lines, or if it's bowl-like and it looks featureless, and there are features, you know,
right.
We've talked about that before on the outside weed line, you know, pick out the... You know, structural elements.
There's always irregularities.
Mm-hmm.
There always are. And it's just like with anything. I mean, it's how much time you're willing to put into it and how much study you're willing to do. You know, not... And this is just overarching, and I don't care where you fish. You can't learn the lake hucking and chucking. Right? Not to the level that it takes to be successful currently, in my opinion. Where it's back in the day, right, when there were 7 people that muskie fished and 3 of them had TV shows, right? You could go out and say, okay, I'm going to throw this and throw that and huck and chuck. And, you know, I know the layout of this spot, per se. Well, you add in pressure that we have now, you add in all these other factors, where you need to understand spot on spot. You need to be finding the small details, you know, especially, you know, the more pressure, the more detail-oriented you need to be consistently successful. Where, you know, throwing a bait at some cover and saying, okay, there's the weed edge, is not sufficient any longer, right? It is, where's the small detail? Where's the... You know, where's the one rock inside this weed bed? Where's the one irregularity on this point? You've got to find those small details and capitalize them on them to be continuous successful. Drew, what's up, meatheads? Just want to know why you don't have a matlock trolling chart. Is it the same as the headlock chart? Looking to hear from you. All your dive curves on your matlocks and headlocks and your supernatural stuff is right about the same. Right? So... That's a good loose rule of thumb on the trolling charts for those guys. With them being wooden baits, there's slight variance. But if you take your headlock chart, that's going to be right about on the money. The matlock's going to run a tick shallower, but you'll be able to dial in from there. That's going to be Your good rule of thumb, Jay. All right. Mike says, does the moon cycle and weather conditions, i.e. storm, overcast, etc., actually affect muskie fishing? If yes, how? And what do I do to find good? Okay, so he's got a compound question here, but does the moon and the weather actually affect muskie fishing? So, cool question. Does it affect muskie's activity levels? Let's say the moon. This is again back and forth on the moon. Earlier in this year, up in Canada, you could set your watch to it, right? Was it something else? Who knows? But it was close enough for Jazz for us to be able to go, okay, we need to be on the best areas and targeting the best areas we have where fish are known to hold during X, Y, and Z's time because something is popping off, right? So, how does the moon affect muskies? I don't know. There is some thread, whether it be completely, no one knows. If you read Next Level Muskie Fishing, my last book, the next one will be done here in a second. I've told everybody that before, but we're finally bearing down and getting that done. Can't be busy enough. But anyway, there's some thin thread between the solar lunar cycle and muskie activity levels. There is. And I don't know what it is. And no one can give me an articulate answer. I don't need anybody's hypotheticals. I don't need conjecture. I don't need my pawpaw set or, don't give a rat's ass about any of that. As far as a hard scientific thing, I've researched it. I've called the biologists. I've been through the ringer on this thing. Nobody has the where, when, why of that, but there's a thin thread there, right? What's happening? We don't know. We're just guessing. I think it has to do with bug hatches or just the life cycle of subaquatic creatures, whether it be algae bloom, whatever. Plankton, excuse me, plankton, anything. Something is spurring the food chain at that time. So moon is a nobody really knows thing. Anybody that says they know, let's see a good thesis on this. As far as weather absolutely affects muskie activity levels, right? And that's a blanket statement. You look at the why. Well, what happens when we get a front coming in? We have lessened light penetration.
Yeah.
Right. Now, is it the humidity? Is it the light penetration? I have fished a lot of cloudy days that weren't productive, and I fished a lot of days when it was about to storm blue blazes, and I caught scuds of them. Right? Is it barometric pressure? Well, barometric pressure is not really a as far as what we know from, and I'm talking again, yet again, from a solid scientific standpoint, and we're talking about muskies only, is that pressure enough for them to feel it? There's no solid evidence. There's no empirical data on that. So I believe that the approaching storm lowers light penetration, allowing fish to move. Everything in freshwater is a predator. The food chain gets stirred up. Muskies subsequently become more active due to that. Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. In preparation for the cold front that's coming on the backside, right? So, weather kickstarts the food chain, absolutely. Why? And I'm talking, we know that it does, but yet again, we don't have a solid answer, right? And that goes back to, there was an article years ago in Fishing Facts magazine where some guy, one of the first people, threw out the whole thing about the barometer in fishing, right? Well, if you research into it, it was just some guy that just kind of said it. It wasn't like, somebody that had their doctorate in ichthyology, right? And so there's no like hard data on the actual why, the 1 + 1 = 2 of the matter. We just know anecdotally that it does, right? Why does the sun set and the moon rise? And here we are like some freaking people you'd see on a National Geographic special, Jay, where we're howling and screeching at the moon and the stars, it's a deity. We
yeah,
don't.
There'd be certainties in this deal. They'd be a lot easier to catch.
Well, there are certainties. We just don't know. 100%. I mean, we are in the Stone Age when it comes to information. So one of the main reasons that I just continually am keeping notes, and hold on, let me take off speaker here. I'm freaking grab a drink out of the cooler. But anyway, one of the reasons I'm keeping notes all the time is exactly that. Can I find the smallest little fact? Can I find something that is substantive, that is like hard data? Right? Because when it comes to these fish and it comes to this experience, there's nothing. Nothing. I mean, you want to hear the fact of the matter. You got the whole freaking background of musky fishing knowledge. I kind of, again, harkening back to the book, right? Is the entire sport of musky fishing has been dictated by the Northwoods in Minnesota for about the last 80 years, right? By a bunch of guys that live around Action Lakes, and that's about the extent of it. That was your information source, right? No hard science, no hard data, no hard anything. It was, you know, when the bite's bad on clear water, go to tannic, right? If they're on bucktail, they're a topwater. There's no like, oh, bang, you know.
Yeah, I caught 62% of my muskies when heavy clouds rolled in.
You know, right. It's like,
okay, odds are up, but, you know.
Why did that have an effect?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the question that I'm always answering. Yes, that's great. We caught a fish, but why? Why did, and that's kind of my quest at all times. I've said on the podcast, I think, where it's like kind of my ethos right now is, yes, you caught a fish, but if you can't tell me why it was there and why you got it, what's the point? Does that make any sense? Because I'm over yeah. The I caught a fish. I mean, I don't care anymore, guys. Sorry. Steve caught a muskie. Whoopty freaking do. To me, it's more unraveling the patterns and habits and the why of it is more interesting to me. And so, you know, if you look at it, there's not been a lot of consideration to the actual why. And that's where, like I said, I'm always keeping notes. Yes, I'm keeping it for patterns and keeping it for, well, this is what I need to be doing under this X, Y, and Z. But there's rules that these fish are adhering to rules that we don't even know exist. I said it with the live scope thing. You know, and I'll stand on pavement, as the kids say, when it comes to these things pair up. Right? I had an email from a guy after I made that statement. They don't pair up. They're solo. No, they are not solo predators. Sorry. Old wives' tale. You know, and some of these new things where you go, that, you know, before you got 60 years of saying these. This was the behemoth jay that laid next to a log and ate frogs and ducks. And, you know, somebody's cousin saw one at the boat landing the size of an alligator. That's about the knowledge base that we started with in the sport. And, you know, looking at it and going, that's the hard part for me. I'm going, these fish are adhering to sets of rules that we don't know even exist. Because I know there's not a guide in the country that doesn't have like this, and this is guide talk, but you'll end up with this one period of time that's a head scratcher, right? Why can't I find them, or what are they doing? And I'm not talking about the spawn. I'm just talking about they're doing something you don't understand and you don't know why. You know, and it's funny, it's like, you look at that Minnesota study that came out on their eating habits, where some of the biggest muskies are eating freaking crayfish. They're eating invertebrates. They're not out here pounding, you know, 30-inch walleye like we thought. So there's a tremendous amount of missing data. I've said it about the current. You know, putting a current pattern together is like working on a redacted letter, right? Well, just muskies in general is so much missing data, right? You've got a few biologists taking a swing at it. They can tell you this is, you know, most of their data is how do we keep these things alive and what kind of environment do we need to provide, right? From a stocking standpoint, You know, they're not really invested in or financially, it makes no difference to them to really have behavioral studies. The closest being, okay, what do they eat? All right, so here's what we know about muskies from a scientific standpoint, like empirical data, right? And I'm sure I'm missing something, and I'll get Bob will email, and that'd be amazing to supplement. But, you know, we know when they spawn. We know how they spawn. We know what their survival rates of the fry are, right? We know the salinity level they can handle. We know the oxygenation levels they can handle. We know their temperature tolerances, right? Dissolve, you know. That's about the shooting match there. We don't know how they compute data, right? Again, the argument can be made about sound. We don't know if it's the drumming effect or if they audibly, if their brain takes that data and they quote unquote hear it, or is it just another vibration? We have no clue how they perceive, right? We have zero concept of how they perceive anything. We know that they can take in sensory input in a vibrational format. We know they can take in sensory input in a sonic format, but are those two things, do they intertwine? Are they perceived as sound? Is sound perceived as vibration? Maybe vibration's perceived as sound. We have no clue, Jay.
Right. Good point.
We have no clue. It might, your bucktail, theoretically, your bucktail could go by a muskie and it could just, he doesn't feel it. He just hears, you know, I doubt it, but no one has the data to disprove that per se. Right? Because we don't know how they perceive. We know what sensory organs that they have. We know they have essentially a rudimentary ear, if you will. And they have, which is connected to their swim bladder and all this other stuff, kind of a drumming effect deal, if you know what that is. And then you have your lateral line. But yet again, you know, it's one of those deals. Do they hear with their eyes and see with their ears? We don't know. We don't know. So that's what's vexing about it. I'm down a rabbit hole bad on this. I apologize, but I don't even know where this started, Jay. Oh, about the moon and all that, about the missing stuff, where it's difficult, and you've got to admit that to yourself. I think that one thing that keeps me creative, and I still get my ass kicked all the time, but what keeps me creative and fluid is there are no rules to this. Or there's no rules. You know, here's best advice, go from there, because we don't have the data to know this is what's taking place. Zero, right? That zero data that is like, this is X, Y, and Z. You know, the only thing I can tell you, and as far as empirical data, there's a study done, Bob and I have discussed, as I'm sure I mentioned on the podcast before, where they blinded a bunch of muskies and they disconnected to the lateral line of a bunch of muskies. Well, the fish that were blinded were fine as far as predation, and the fish that had a disconnected lateral line were not doing so hot, that kind of deal. So we know that sound and vibration play heavily, but again, how they perceive it, we don't know. Anyway, so that's the hard part when you're trying to look for whether the moon... What does the moon do? I don't know. It shows up and something happens on occasion. What does weather do? We know it juices them up a little bit. But anybody that says it's doing X, Y, and Z, you know, I want to see the research pattern. I want to see the research paper on it. Right? Because everything we're saying and everything we're doing in this sport is gut feeling, anecdotal experience. That's it. And you got to realize that. So anything that I say, take it with a grain of salt, because that's my experience on the water and it may not be yours. And you might find something that I've never even encountered. Or you might find something that works on your water. And that's kind of the interesting thing, because this is still kind of we've painted the tiniest corner of this canvas of what these fish do. The rest is a mystery. So anyway.
Yeah.
$1.90, I'll get you a cup of coffee, Jay. Anyway, what we got here? Brandon, what? Take a drink. What? All right. Brandon, I've recently started fishing for muskie and I had a few bites where they just grabbed the tail on my bait and then spit it out. For reference, I'm using a large paddle tail. One time I tried setting a hook. The second time I tried waiting to see if it bit more. In both cases, both fish end up following me to the boat, but end up losing him in the figure eight process. Should I set the hook when I feel a bite or wait? Jay, talk this new musky angler through when we set the hook, when we don't, especially if they're nipping.
Well, you set the hook immediately if a fish, if you can feel the bite. Now, if it's something visual, and that happens all the time with surface baits, yep. Where you see a disturbance and you might see the fish come out of the water and shoot the bait, you know, it's like, if you don't feel it on, don't set the hook, wait on that one. But yeah, for subsurface baits, if that fish bit the, that's your best shot, not to wait to see if it's, this isn't walleye fishing. There's a big difference in terms of the strike, you know, so immediately set the hook.
And there's a big difference between a nip and a strike, right? And especially with a paddle tail, if you've got one coming in there tagging the tail on it, might be time to downsize, right? Or you just might have gotten in front of a fish that's not quite that active, but, you know, you might want to come back to him. So that's the thing. I mean, the old adage, Jay, hook sets are free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hook sets are free. Bob, do you have any tricks to keep the tail attached to a hellhound? The tail on mine keeps coming off no matter how I glue it. Okay, well, hopefully you're not using Elmer's glue. What I will do with a hellhound is just use the Gorilla Super Glue. That's all I do. I don't know why you'd have an issue. If you have one that it keeps coming off, take your freaking Smitty file or whatever. Take the tail off and clean off the old adhesive, the old super glue or whatever you have on there. Clean it off. Make sure you don't have any like oil on the surface. That's the only thing I know that hurts adhesion.
True.
So just make sure the bait's clean. This is going to
And different super glues have different properties with different plastics too. That is well known, well documented.
Yes.
And that goes back to like repairing some plastic baits like bulldogs or medusas or something get torn up. You know, you got a big slash in it or part of the tail's gone. You try gluing it back on. Some work better than others because there's different formulas in all these plastics.
And I hate paying for it because I'm a cheapo, but I always keep the Gorilla brand super glue. It seems to work the best on musky baits. You know, because you have like that Mendit soft plastic glue and all this different stuff. I don't need like all these different super glues in the boat. The Gorilla brand super glue, I just use it sparingly. And it keeps the tails on all my baits that need a glued on tail, or I can repair like a Mustang or a Magnus with that pretty easily. But like I said, if you're having adhesion problems with the tail, one of the goofiest things is usually there's something on it.
Yeah, scrape it and rough it up.
Yep, scrape it. Yep, get the old glue off. It's a bait. You're trying to get teeth marks in it. Don't worry. Don't be precious with the damn thing. It's a tool, not a toy, right? Clean off the back end with your file. The other thing I've done with baits, and this is kind of on that tip, but on a different tip. Every now and again, if you have baits that you're fishing a lot, and they start getting cruddy, right? Or you're having like, you can't glue them back together. Wash them with Dawn in the sink. I've had that before, and you got to realize, like, if you're fishing, like, I've got some glide baits and some different stuff, you know, that's in the water all the time. I mean, there's tons of crap in the water. I mean, your freaking engine's exhaust is going in the water, right? Every boat on the water, their exhaust is expelling oil into the water. And so every now and again, I like to just take my baits that I'm really using a bunch. I'm talking, I've been guiding like 60 days straight kind of crap, you know, and I'll take them, put on these split rings, on new hooks on them. And when I've got them all cleaned up, I'll just freaking wash them down real quick. Just so they're a little less cruddy. I know that sounds weird, but you actually notice like they get filmy, you know, they'll kind of get a gross little film on the baits. And that's another trick too, as an aside. For your big rubber baits, especially you guys that are using an underboss, you know, the little tackle caddy thing I came up there with Josh, you'll notice driving around with those, you'll get crud on your rubber baits, and it's just grease and oil from the road, right, from driving around, and that will help you too. Anyway, Jay, what bait washing, other than casting them and not catching a fish, that's what you, That's what I caught when we're not catching, is we're washing baits. But, you know, oh, and as an aside, talk about another ADD moment. I say washing baits. We're talking about reef hogs up in Canada, Jay. The old reef hog trick?
The reef hog trick? Okay.
Yeah, which is just sticking them in the sink or in your cooler and letting them get waterlogged before you fish them.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, sure. That was the classic anyway. Yeah. Washing their baits. What we got here?
Because you want it less buoyant. Well, sometimes you want it buoyant so it's snappy.
All right, Mark in Wisconsin, can you talk about lure style combinations for the front of the boat, back of the boat? All right, so front of the boat, back of the boat combos. Which lure styles complement one another? Yeah, that's a great concept. We've talked about it in the past, but it's definitely, you know, the classic is put the guy with the top water in the back and the guy with the blades in the front. I look at it from a different standpoint anymore. The way that conversation and the complementary baits had taken shape in the past was essentially the guide didn't want the baits getting in his way. Right? So you went from fastest to slowest. Right? That was kind of the motif. Is the faster baits are in the front, the slower baits are in the back. So that you're not overlapping or getting entangled in each other's lines. My preference currently is that I've got a shock and awe bait in the front of the boat. So a lot of times, if I'm worried about combinations, I will have, say, a Kraken up front followed by a shallow invader. Right? That's one of my favorite combos, to be honest with you. Is, okay, here's this Kraken coming through the water that's running deep and contouring cover and structure, and then I have a shallow invader running like 2 feet. The amount of fish I've seen on LiveScope that come up, they look at the freaking Kraken, they break off that and just rocket ship that shallow invader is ridiculous. And the way I look at it is the guy in the front wakes him up and the guy behind him catches him. All right? Mm-hmm. Another combination that I like is 10-inch Phantoms and 10-inch Hellhounds followed by a small glide bait. And I do that all the time guiding. I haven't caught a fish on one of those in so long, I can't tell you, but the amount I have moved that have woken up and eaten another bait's ridiculous. Right? So,
yeah, you're looking at the rear seat guy lost my train of thought.
Well, that's
is the go ahead.
Well, that's that for me, because I have to run so much current, right? I'm that's why a lot of people go, why are you in the front? There's a lot of days I'm running backwards, right? And I don't know what current's going to be on any given day, so I'm the back of the boat is the front of the boat in my boat. But if I don't have enough current, then you know, whatever, we're not going to do a big flip floppy roo there. But what I like to do, like I said, is shock and awe combos. I said that's not like the chaos rod. That's a great name though.
So shock and awe in the front,
right?
And throwback guy in the back.
Yeah, essentially, or a wake them up kind of bait where that's big 10-inch Phantoms followed by somebody throwing a Manta, and they just I'm telling you, it's like a deep, and way too big followed by moderately shallow. Similar bait class. And that's the weird thing is like the old adage would be, you've got to be throwing two different baits or you, no one throws the same thing. Bullshit. That's what I say to that. Bullshit. If they're moving on gliders, guess what? Well, all three of us will throw freaking gliders. I don't care. But from a guide standpoint, I want something that's waking fish up. So generally, bigger and bolder than it needs to be. I do think there's a modicum of value to adding vibration to the water, right? And even if a muskie doesn't see it, or let's say they see it and feel it and they engage and they don't want it, or even if they just feel it, there's things going on, there's things taking place. So if I'm really struggling or things are slow, that's generally what I'll do is a, say like a big glider, a small glider, or like a Kraken and a crank, just complimentary in the sense of here's a big presentation, here's a moderate presentation for them to kind of dial in on. You know, it's hard when you look at, say, like, you could look at like a good combination for shallow stuff is going to be like a Civic and a Titan and like slammers. That's not a bad compliment, right? But again, in my opinion, that's kind of like a big bait and a medium bait kind of compliment there. You know, you can do a lot of damage, like I said, in working in that tandem where the guy that's sending the big shock and awe bait, yeah, he might not get as many hits, but the ones he does are worthwhile. But, I mean, as far as a classic compliment of two baits that are going to run well together, yeah, you want a guy on blades, you want a guy in topwater, okay? You want the other one you used to hear all the time, have somebody on a Suic in the back and a guy with a bucktail in the front. Behave like, and it almost gets back to what we talked about, Jay, like seeing the behavior of muskies, say, especially with the aid of live imaging. Dude, the amount of fish that I will move off of, say, a reef or a rocky point that I will pull off the bottom, and now I've got them up to 8 feet, and we go back over the top of them with a crankbait or a glide bait, and they eat is ridiculous. Right? So that's why I'm doubling down on, you know, it doesn't have to be a pounder, but like a 10-inch bait and an 8-inch bait. I'm thinking size class more so than anything. You know, I'll run 10 and a 7. I don't care. You could run a 10-inch glider and a 7-inch glider. I don't care. But a big bait to pull them up and a smaller bait to catch them. That is often my combination. And like I said, until you live it, breathe it, eat it, sleep it, and you go, oh, there he came up. He looked at the tube. Now he's no longer on the bottom at 15, and he's now at 8 feet. And guess what he does when he has that one shallow bait run over him? Whackety schmackety. So that's kind of the thought process there. So, you know, there's no hard, fast rules as far as that combos, but that kind of game plan, that kind of thought process has served me well here. All right, Daryl. Hey, guys, I want to add jigging to my game. I gave it some runtime last trip by running a shoreline midday, running a 15 to 20-foot break line with a Poseidon. I worked the bottom 5 feet, 8 miles, blah, 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 blah. Okay, he just wants to know if he's on the right track. He worked the bottom at 5 feet at 0.8 miles an hour. Any tips or insight on jigging program? So, he was working with Poseidon. I would recommend working it with an actual vertical jig. Get your hands on a Bondi or a Pegasus from Chaos. What else? I don't like the Shumway Fuzzy does as much as I used to anymore, just because now you got Bondis. But the most important thing that you can do when we're vertically jigging is keep your jig vertical. Right? It sounds simple, but it's harder to do in practice than it is to say it. So if you have wind pushing you, you need to accommodate for the wind. You need to accommodate for current, whatever is present that keeps that jig vertical. We're not trying to hop and skip and jump on the bottom. We're trying to make repeated bottom contact, which is the number one key, right? Is that when we're working these jigs, that each time it hits the bottom and then it's coming up and it hits the bottom again and it's slowly advancing, right? It's a very deliberate motion. The one thing that I see when people try to start vertically jigging that they do completely wrong off the rip is they move it too much. They feel like that bait has to come up 8 feet and fall 8 feet. It does not. I've caught plenty of muskies jigging a Bondi, and I'm generally moving that bait 12 to 18 inches.
Yeah.
Right? And it's a controlled fall. I don't just pull it up and then let it fall and then pull it up again. It is pulled up under tension and is lowered back down under tension. Right? It's a controlled thing the entire time. And I'm lifting that rod generally about a foot. The way I like to set my setup, and this is one little dialed in thing with jigging now that I've gotten into, is I let my jig hit the bottom, and I reel to my rod tip is just about an inch or two above the surface, right? And that allows me to have some hook set room on the uptick when I get a grab, right? So I don't want to have any longer, you know, the original kind of principle on that was to have that rod straight out in front of you, very level. And it's much like fishing a tube. You don't have a lot of places to go with it. So I like to keep a low rod tip so that if I get that strike, I've got plenty of room on the upswing to really drive the hooks home if needed.
Yeah, it's key.
Yeah, I am, when I'm jigging, it is a small controlled motion. The difference is so abundantly clear with live imaging. Again, talked about live imaging, but you want to learn about musky behavior. That's what's amazing about it, right? What will they do? What will they don't? What do they respond positively to, negatively to? Blah, blah, blah. If I'm jigging in as tough conditions and no one else is catching fish, I better keep that a small motion. And these things will just come out of nowhere on you. And especially watching on live, you're just jigging along, and there they come. And they will pace you for longer than you think, right? I'm not trying to do anything crazy. Jigging should be very simple and controlled. And a lot of guys in musky fishing, they want to be doing too much. This is not the time to do too much. 12-inch stroke to an 18-inch stroke up and down, lift it under tension, and let back down. So once you lift it up about a foot, lower it back down, right? It's always under tension. There should never be any play in your line when you're vertically jigging. And keep it straight up and down. Advance kind of slow. He said he was moving at 0.8. I mean, I don't know what the conditions were, if the wind wouldn't let you go any slower, but generally I want to even advance even slower.
Yeah, I would say still.
Yeah, I don't want to ever, the bait should never drag. It should be vertical. So if that line is getting behind the boat, you're going too fast. If the line is getting in front of the boat, you're going too slow.
Yeah, 0.8. I'd cut that speed down in half. 0.4 is just an ideal speed to cover water effectively and saturate better.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of those things. I think a lot of times when it comes to jigging, it is such a Hail Mary or an afterthought for people, right, that they're not thinking about where they're jigging. Like, oh, well, we should vertically jig because we haven't caught anything. And they just set up shop wherever. Like, okay, that's not going to do anything for you. So, you know, what I like to do is I'm really looking at that first major break as a consideration. And any major changes is where I'm going to vertically jig, as well as the contact point where the structure comes one with the main basin. That's a deadly place to kind of do that presentation. But like I said, jigging is most effective when you keep it stupid simple. Just keep it simple. And, you know, the only big thing you got to look out for is when a fish grabs it and he's coming up vertically with it and you got to reel up real fast, because sometimes they'll grab that bait and scream for the surface, which is a whole other animal. But anyway, Jaybird, I got to get my butt back on the boat here, sir.
Right.
All right, buddy. Well, say good night. After texting you, morning still.
Yeah, good morning, guys.
Good day, thanks, mate. Later.
Bye-bye now. Did you think I'd show up in the Ranger boat? No, had to save my money for a live scope.